up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd, joined once again by my co-host who covers the team for The Athletic as well. Back from Jamaica, back from island life, he is Thomas Drance. What's going on, man?
Not much. Great to be back.
Great to have you back.
In the tropical environs of the 650 studio.
It's not hot in here.
It's hot in here.
Yeah, the producers seem to be not having a good time in the control room.
I'm sorry,
I feel
guys.
Fine.
I always wanted to visit the rainforest.
Well, now you have. You guys are just like me in Jamaica.
Drance, this is how you punish us for coming back?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Just like me in Jamaica.
Heat it up.
Did you ever watch Archer?
Of course.
There's the Pam goes to Jamaica and comes back. That's what I've been thinking this whole time. You're going to come back like Pam, speaking in the Rasta accent and everything.
Well, Halford and Brough joked that I would come back with a single, what's it called?
Dreadlock?
Dreadlock, yeah. A single dreadlock, which I would then refer to as my side tail.
Well, thank you for not doing that.
Oh, yeah.
It makes it much more comfortable here.
Hey, I couldn't if I tried.
It's true. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio, Kintec Footwear and Orthotics, working together with you in step. You have something to say?
No. You keep going.
All right. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And this hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. You need forklifts that perform under pressure and pallet racking that maximizes your space. Visit them online at racksteel.com. A big show coming up today. Dimitri is going to join us. I feel like I haven't talked to Dimitri in forever, so excited to have him on. A little earlier than normal. He's going to join us at 1. And we'll wrap up the week with Harmon Dial, also from The Athletic, at 1:30. So Dimitri at 1, Harmon at 1:30, which means we got an open hour here. Before that, you had a great piece up at The Athletic today, which we can talk about comparing.
Thank you, buddy.
I love your work at The Athletic so much. comparing where the Canucks are, what they need to do relative to the final four teams playing in the conference finals right now. We can get into that, but we should probably start on the conference finals themselves, and specifically what the hockey world witnessed last night, which was just an absolute beatdown. About as dominant a performance as you're going to see at this stage of the season, on the road, no less, as the Florida Panthers, they just continue to roll. They beat Carolina 5-0. They're up 2-0 in that series. What's that, 14 straight now? Conference final losses for the Carolina Hurricanes, dating all the way back to 2009.
Yeah, so like some of that is, a reflection.
I think we can chalk 10 of them up to this current team.
Yeah.
The other four from 2009, it's like we don't need to include those.
I mean, I feel like the Panthers are at this level where they start throwing their fastball. No one can really keep up with it. Like Carolina was the better team in the first period of this series.
Mm-hmm.
And then for 25 minutes until it was 5-1, the Florida Panthers just demolished them with like a level of gas that it seemed like the Hurricanes couldn't muster any resistance to. And I wonder if there's a cumulative effect of like, because you remember the first loss between these two teams back in 2003 was the like triple overtime game, and then it was another overtime game in game two. Like, it's not like this came
that was the year where Brendan Moore was like, hey, it was close,
and it was,
and he had a leg to stand on.
But it's like, and I felt like this during that Leaf series too, where when the Panthers won game three to make it 2-1, it felt like they were hanging on by their fingernails. Like, the Leafs were a shot away.
Well, what? The Leafs were up 3-1 in that game, and then it went to overtime.
Well, and the Panthers were turning up, but it like at 5-5 in that game, it was not a barrage of Panthers chances, and this feels inevitable, right? Like, the Leafs were counterpunching. They had their chances. They had a lot of good ones.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it feels like you miss your shot against this Panthers team because they can turn up and hit this gear that's just so damn high. They break you. They break you eventually. And they broke the Maple Leafs, and it feels like they came into the series having already broken the Carolina Hurricanes.
And since they lost the first two to the Leafs, they're what? They're now 6-1 since then.
Yeah.
The one loss being the game six loss to the Leafs. And their last four games on the road have just been
five goals.
Absolute bludgeonings of the other team.
They have so many good players, man.
It is interesting, right, because there's the debate and the consistent conversation about, see, Carolina, it doesn't work in the playoffs, right? It can only get you so far. And I think that's fair enough. There's some truth to that. I also think it's a problem that a lot of teams would love to have. It's like, oh, hey, we're banging our head against the ceiling in the conference finals. How do we take that next step? But I also feel like,
well, they know. The problem with them is they know.
They've tried to address it.
But
my point is, like, I think the tactical conversation is kind of missing that, like, there's a lot of similarities between Florida and Carolina.
Correct.
Florida's just, like, better Carolina.
Correct.
Like, Florida, to me, is what Carolina is trying to get to when they go acquire Miko Rantanen and Jake Guentzel. It's like marrying the super high-end skill onto our system of hockey and our forechecking and our pressure and all of that. And you're seeing why they want to do that, because Florida is just as capable of playing to their identity and playing with that much intensity as Carolina is, but they have better players. And so, well, who do you think is going to win? The team with the better players, who's also capable of playing to that identity.
Yeah, the truth is, right, is this is such a good point by you, man.
Thank you.
And, you know, the Carolina Hurricanes have, like, their third most used forward is Jordan Staal.
Yeah.
Right? Their fourth most used forward is Jackson Blake, who is, like, 19 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Seth Jarvis, still pre-prime. Logan Stankoven, pre-prime. Martin Nukes in the top nine.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, Kotkaniemi is their third, like, is fringe fourth, like, a fringe third liner. 12 minutes a game, 5-on-5. 12 and a half. Whereas with the Panthers, you go down and it's, like, Lundell, who, you know, I think could play probably top line forward for a lot of teams mm-hmm. around the league. Luostarinen, who might be one of the most unique top six defensive specialist power forwards we've got. Just an absolute dog. Brad Marchand, third liner, sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just come at you in these waves. Like, their first line has two Selke finalists on it. Their second line is, so
one of whom scored, what, 57 goals? Like, was that last year?
Yeah, and the other of whom is Sasha Barkov. And then they've got the second line, and, like, secretly, as we saw in that Leafs series, actually, the soft spot, the soft point of this Panthers team is Bennett, Tkachuk, and Verhaeghe. If that's your weakness, and by the way, do you know why that's their weakness?
Why?
That's their weakness because they're the one line that actually plays offensively calibrated, will take some chances, will cheat a little bit, will mm-hmm. open it up to score. They're the one line that has the highest obligation to generate offense for the Panthers, but they're also the one that goes about it in the most typical way, as opposed to, like, Barkov and Reinhardt are generating chances while also never once leaning to the wrong side of the puck, never taking a chance on a read. Lundell and Luostarinen do the exact same thing. Bennett, Tkachuk, and Verhaeghe will actually play, like, some run-and-gun hockey here and there. They will actually take chances carrying the puck in. They will avoid doing just the pure soft rims and forecheck things. Like, they will take risks and make reads and try to make plays. And your only chance against the Panthers is to punish that line and win that matchup, which, you know, in order to do, you have to outscore Verhaeghe, 40-goal guy, Bennett, absolute Canadian hero, monster. Also, you know, keep your head up. And then Matthew Tkachuk, elite playmaking power forward, and also keep your head up. Mm-hmm. I mean, good luck, right? Like, it's just a brutal gauntlet that you have to run through. So I sometimes struggle with these shows because it's like, should we do news of the day or should we talk about all the things that I didn't get to talk about over the last 10
mm-hmm.
days?
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that got ignored, and now that the Panthers have run roughshod over Carolina, so it's like, this would have been a sick take a week ago, but now it's, like, more common. But one of the things that was ignored because everyone was so mad at the Maple Leafs choking again.
Yes.
Was that they did a remarkable job making the Panthers sweat. Like, a really incredible job making the Panthers sweat. And people just want to dump on all of these excellent players that the Maple Leafs have that are personally responsible for the failures while ignoring the extent to which, like, Florida has a lot better players than the Leafs do. You know, and mm-hmm. even the guys, like, it's so crazy how the conversation just congeals around Marner and ignores, like, on that key second goal, you've got just a brutal lost puck battle. It's not even a 50-50. It's like a 75 Leafs should retain possession down low that Max Domi just completely loses. No one's going to criticize Max Domi because he scored a couple goals in that series, including the 3-1 goal in Game 7, which was ultimately meaningless.
That's because he has the passion.
Well, and there's occasionally these sick shots of Ty Domi in the Leafs crowd that's going nuts after a Max. And like, I get it. It's a romantic moment. Like, I understand. But Max Domi is not... Max Domi is a one-dimensional player,
mm-hmm.
right? He's perfectly slotted on that Leafs team, but he's also not Luostarinen. Like, he's not good enough to make the difference against a team with the sort of gear that Florida has. And then the puck goes the other way, and it's Carlo who doesn't just lose his guy and take the wrong guy, but the box out prevents, I think it was Jake McCabe from getting over. No, it was McCabe or Larson, Ekman Larson, from getting over to stop Luis Dronin. Boom, 2-0. Like, and it's just like the Panthers don't have guys that make those errors. And these are guys that the Leafs have either like paid a lot to acquire. They traded a top prospect center who's probably going to play for the Bruins next season in a first for Carlo, who is like the exact template of defender that does not help you against the Florida Panthers, by the way, because he can't move the puck and beat their forecheck. Right? And Max Domi, a guy they pay like $4 million a year. He's a fourth line energy guy. Like, they messed up with Marner, not in terms of giving him another shot, but in terms of not controlling the situation. To lose a player of that caliber, like, it's hard enough to lose a player of Besser's caliber. I think the Canucks deserve a ton of criticism for getting to this point with Besser. With a player like Marner, we're talking about a top 10 forward in the league. Like, that's wild. And then people will say stuff like, well, I think Treliving did a good job. It's like, what? What are you talking about? That's an incredible amount of value to bleed.
I do think, by the way, I've seen the take out there from Leafs fans watching Florida thump Carolina.
I know.
And they're like, oh, imagine we could be beating Carolina like this. No, you wouldn't.
No.
But you just got blown out by Florida. Did you not remember that?
But it's not that they could beat Carolina or be like a match. It's that they played well.
Yeah.
They hit their absolute ceiling given the talent left on that roster. Right? They did. Like, that was very much Canucks-y. It was very much like what happened with the Canucks and the Oilers, where they had a great game plan. They performed really well. They made a much far superior team sweat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And at the absolute apex of the series, when everything was on the line, the massive gulf between who they were and who their opponent were was mad evident. But like, they had the same season the Canucks had last year. It's just that 10 years of failure make it impossible to talk about it routinely. And now people are like, should the Canucks even get Mitch Marner? Are you kidding me?
It's also an all-time irrelevant conversation.
All-time irrelevant conversation.
Guess what, guys? It's not happening.
It's not happening. But also, there's no amount that you could pay that would be a bad move.
Okay, I want to bring it back to Carolina. No, it's all right. I want to bring it back to Carolina, Florida here. Let's say this series...
The takes around the Leafs just drive me nuts. When I was in Jamaica, every now and then I'd log on to Twitter, and I'd be like, this conversation is completely off the rails.
Let's say Carolina gets swept again, right? Looks like it's heading in that direction. We'll see. It's hockey. You never know. But they're going back to Florida. They're down 2-0.
Yeah, they've been dog-walked for 2 games.
Who picks up the phone to call the other one first? Eric Tulsky or Jim Rutherford on Elias Pettersson? Because Tulsky's been in it a couple times now. On Elias Pettersson.
Well, I think Eric Tulsky.
You think that's one of his first calls?
I know. Because
somebody texted it in, is Brendan Moore getting fired if they get swept?
No,
they love Rod Brendan Moore. He's taken a massive discount to stay there. They're not, as much as they're going to tweak things and still try to add that talent, they're not throwing out the whole system that's got them there. Again,
they told you with the Rantanen move and then the Rantanen departure what they want. They want to level up and have elite talent playing Rod Brindamore's style of hockey.
Yeah.
They tried it with Gensel, couldn't keep him. They tried it with Rantanen, and instead of eat the sort of bleeding cost of that departure, they'd be better off in this series with Rantanen, obviously. We all know that, but they didn't want to take one swing. They want to take a multi-year swing. They want a locked-in star player. My guess would be that the Carolina Hurricanes and the Vancouver Canucks have never really stopped. Right? Because we also know that they talked about Pettersson and Miller with the Carolina Hurricanes before they acquired
Rantanen. It's been at least twice, well-sourced reporting, right? One before Pettersson signed the contract, and then most recently in January, before ultimately they did the Rantanen deal. And so clearly, as they look around and target where they can find that high-end talent, and I think it's especially notable that the two swings they've taken, the really big swings they've taken, Gensel and Rantanen, were pending UFAs. Of course, that's not, as we all know, that is not an issue with Elias Pettersson. So if part of their concern is not just the trade acquisition, finding a player, but then
trapping
him under contract. Yeah.
The old trapping guy.
You can't walk. You're stuck here.
Yeah.
I mean, that helps explain, I think, some of the interest they might have in Elias Pettersson.
I mean, people forget now, but do you remember what Sam Reinhart's reputation was when the Florida Panthers acquired him?
It was the reputation that almost anyone who plays in Buffalo has. You know what I mean? Where it's like, he can't win.
It was uniquely bad.
Really? I don't think so. I think the Jack Eichel one was worse than Sam Reinhart.
The Jack Eichel one was worse. Jack Eichel would be more like Mitch Marner, though.
Yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, we all know he's good, but...
Right.
Reinhart, it was like... We think he's not a winner at all.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think he plays the right way. We don't think he can handle the pressure. Like, that was the conversation. Remember those clips of, like, Reinhart and Mike Harrington getting into it that went everywhere?
Uh-huh.
He seemed, like, surly and sullen and on and on. I mean, Sam Reinhart was viewed a very specific way when the Florida Panthers acquired him, and he is now uniquely or universally regarded as one of the top two-way wingers in the sport. He scored a Stanley Cup-winning goal. Consecutive 50-goal seasons.
Yeah.
Selke nominee the last 2 years. I mean, literally the best of the best. So, yeah, I mean, that's something to bear in mind, right? Sam Bennett was acquired for 2 seconds. He was seen as like a bottom six guy who couldn't get out of his own way, right? And just keep that in mind. Like, as down as someone is, as you are on Elias Pettersson, right? Like, these are, you got to swing the bat to win.
I wouldn't be shocked at all if a team acquires Elias Pettersson and it works out really well for them.
Yeah, I'd be more surprised if it worked out really well for the Canucks.
I'm more than anything increasingly skeptical of the turnaround happening here.
Yeah.
That's the issue for me more so than it happening anywhere.
Yeah, it sucks.
Like, I get why Carolina would want to take that swing.
No, for sure.
But they so it's not. I don't want anyone think I'm going on record as saying, like, you know, he'll never win anywhere or you can't win from anything like that. I don't think that's true.
I'm more talking the Royal League.
But it also might make sense. Sure, okay. Make sense to trade him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I don't...
You mean the Royal We, including Jason Brough. That's
yes,
what you're talking
about. Yes, I mean the people who are like, why would anyone ever want this guy?
Sure,
Or people thinking the same about Mitch Marner. I mean, again, Matthew Tkachuk. People forget now, but Matthew Tkachuk's playoff performances with the Calgary Flames were...
Mm-hmm.
Left a lot to be desired. Like, a lot. A lot. And... People have just kind of memory hold it, you know, and I get it. He's awesome. It's like, why wouldn't he be an amazing player? But, you know, his first across his first 15 playoff games, 3 appearances, all round one losses by a Calgary Flames team that in 2 of those occasions entered the playoffs as division winners. He had 5 points and 3 goals in 15 games. You know, like the next year when Calgary finally won around. -6. He had 10 points in 12 games and was like almost played off the ice against McDavid and the Oilers in that 5 or 6 game series win.
Mm-hmm.
People thought this guy, like, not that people thought he couldn't win, but people certainly noted that, hey, this is not a guy who's produced the way he has in the regular season in the playoffs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ignore that stuff, man. Just bet on talent. That's all you can do. That's all you can do. And by the way, because this is the other one we have to really prepare people for, the amount of discussions I'm seeing where it's like, you can't pay Marner 14. You can't pay Marner $14 million. What are you talking about?
And Sam Bennett's the one in the out there today, yeah. Right? That he's going to
$10 million.
Who was it? EJ Raddick said there's at least one team that's going to offer him $10 million.
At least one team. Every team should be willing to pay Sam Bennett $10 million. Like, this is the flip side of the flat cap era, right? We are through the looking glass now. No one has been a more like preserve cap space absolutist more than me, I think it's fair to say, since I first read the MOU back in 2020 and really grasped it and thought, oh my God, this is going to be an era of austerity unlike anything we've ever seen, and cap space is going to be the most valuable asset, and 90% of the league is going to be available completely free if you're simply willing to take on the full freight of their contract. Like, that was my main takeaway from the MOU on, and for 5 years I've been beating that drum. And in a world where the cap's going to be, what, 95.5 this year? I mean, that's an incredible amount of growth. And, you know, what was onerous under the prior system is no longer going to be where we're at now. Like,
we're also already seeing this play out, by the way, with long-term contracts that were signed in the last couple of years.
Totally.
Like, how different does Filip Hronek's deal look today?
JT Miller.
Yeah.
You know,
Bo Horvat. You know what I mean? Well, a lot of those long-term deals for guys in that range where you're like, well, he's maybe not a first line center,
glad,
but you're paying
they didn't
him like
sign
one.
That.
Yeah. Now it's like, man, if the Canucks, and I don't think the Canucks are going to shop Filip Hronek, But I get the talking point, because if you did,
yeah,
for a guy
value.
That age or signed for that long at that number, teams would be like, oh, wow, that's a really interesting contract.
Well, and if you sign for $14 million in a $95.5 million cap environment, like the equivalent adjusted for cap growth is $12 million in an $81.5 million cap environment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, none of us would have blinked an eye at $12 million for Marner 2 years ago. We'd have been like, yeah, that makes sense. Bennett at 10 in a $95.5 million cap environment is the equivalent of 8.5 in the flat cap era. That's the Bo Horvat number. If I were to offer you 7 years of Sam Bennett or 5 years of Bo Horvat, would you have to think about which one you'd prefer?
No.
You'd prefer Sam Bennett?
Yeah.
Okay. Bo Horvat scores more. Sam Bennett's more proven.
I get we're doing it in a vacuum, not from a Canucks perspective here, but I find the whole bring Horvat back thing to be kind of perplexing. So maybe that's coloring my opinion here.
Yeah, I mean, you guys all hated
it's like,
him
it's over.
12 months
I don't
ago.
Get it.
Also, like, remember the whole I'll tell you
yeah,
that for free
like, what's
thing?
Happening like, here?
The amount that fans can just switch their mind. Anyway, sorry, I wasn't even talking about it from a Canucks perspective.
Yeah, you're
I'm just
right.
saying. Point is comparable.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
One scores more, one has more intangible value in that he is, you know, better able to injure opponents without being penalized for it. And what?
It's true.
Hey, it's a dark art.
Uh-huh.
Play tough, baby. Anyway, the fact is that I don't think you should even blink at that. Don't even consider it. And then I'd add this, the last part of this, which is that it's going to be hard to spend your cap space well. Like, teams are going to spend their cap space really badly because it's going to be hard, given the slim number of players worth overpaying that are going to be available on the market versus, those players or those teams that have just droves of cap space. So this is the fundamental reason why you shouldn't even worry about these numbers, in my opinion. We are reaching an inflection point where the scarce resource is not going to be cap space, but is going to be talent. And just like I thought teams should be extremists in protecting their cap space and seizing those opportunities available to them, I now think if you ever have a shot to land an elite player, get them on the roster and figure it out later if you have to. Like, any team or any fan base swallowing that a GM is saving money for next year's free agent class, like, give your head a shake and learn an ounce of critical thinking. Just go land the best players you can, because guess what? That's going to strengthen your recruiting pitch next summer too. Figure out the issues. Teams are going to be desperate to figure out what to do with their cap space. Bad contracts, immovable contracts 3 years ago, are going to become values. Just whatever talent you can bring in, bring it in. Hold on long and fast. Don't worry about the number. Worry about the talent.
Okay, a couple of things I want to hit here before we take a quick break. First of all, tonight, Abbotsford Canucks have a chance to close out the Colorado Eagles and advance to the Western Conference Finals in the Calder Cup playoffs, of course, coming off that overtime win, thanks to Linus Karlsson. Game 4 in that series tonight at 6. Brandon Astle has the call on Sportsnet 650. Also, it's time for One to Watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. It's Dallas and Edmonton tonight in game 2 of that series. And with Dallas getting the win in game 1, this feels like a McDavid and Draisaitl special, but I'll limit it to one, to Connor McDavid. I'm expecting a monster performance from Connor McDavid tonight in Dallas as the Oilers look to even that series up and they try to outscore whatever Stuart Skinner's going to do in net for them tonight. That's One to Watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. It's time to put on your Toyo tires, whether you drive a car, light truck, or van. Toyo tires are designed to perform in all kinds of conditions. Visit Delaney's OK Tire in Langley and Alder Grove. How do the Canucks stack up with the conference finalists? We'll get into that next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. It is Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz here. We are live from the Kintech Studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at RackSteel.com. Send those texts in, but as mentioned, I wanted to dig into one of the Drance's latest piece up at The Athletic today, which is all about getting the measuring stick out and seeing how the Canucks and their current roster measures up to what we're seeing from the NHL's conference finalists. And Chef Graham just texted in. He said, I watched a lot of the conference finals. The more I watched, the more I realized that the Canucks are nowhere near that tier of game or tier of teams. Burn it all down. Scorched earth rebuild. Let's go. That's from Chef Graham. And I think that's a pretty natural, maybe not the burn it down, scorched earth thing, but the realization of how far the Canucks have to go. And I should also say, like, how far a lot of teams have to go in the NHL. We were just having the talk quickly off air before we came back. And I was making this point on the show last week as well when the Final Four was set. The dominance of these four teams, what did you say, 11 of the last 16 Final Four appearances belong to these four teams?
So 69%, nice.
Very good.
Of semifinal berths, conference final berths across the last four seasons belong to these teams. Edmonton has been in three of the last four, with the exception being the year that they didn't advance because they lost to the Stanley Cup winning Vegas Golden Knights. Florida is making it for the third time in a row. The fourth time, by the way, they lost to the Stanley Cup champion, Tampa Bay Lightning. The Carolina Hurricanes are here for the second time in 4 years, and the Dallas Stars are here for the third consecutive year.
Yep.
So 11 of 16 times.
And it's pretty remarkable also that we're talking about this run of these teams dominating, and we're not even including Tampa, which won two straight cups and went to three straight finals not that long ago. Or Colorado, which hasn't had the other deep runs, but won a cup again a few years ago, right? So, like, those are the other high-end teams, I think, of these last, what, five, six seasons, we would say. And
well,
that group of teams has really separated themselves from the rest of the league, I think it's fair to say.
And I would add this, like, Dallas, the year that they didn't make it, 2022, right? They lost to the Stanley Cup-winning Colorado Avalanche.
Yeah.
Right? The Florida Panthers lost that
Vegas
year.
Vegas would be the other team in that category, yeah.
Right. Colorado was, so Dallas, the last time they didn't make it, they lost to the Stanley Cup winner.
Mm-hmm.
Florida, the last time they didn't win it, they lost to the defending Stanley Cup winning Tampa Bay Lightning on their third consecutive trip.
Yep.
Right? So it's like, even the times that these teams don't make it, they don't make it because they're losing to a team that we know is of similar quality.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they're not losing to Cinderella teams. It's not,
yeah.
It's not... Like, there is no world.
Well, like, Vegas lost to Edmonton this year, yeah, et cetera, et cetera.
Just get in and anything can happen is so dead. And if you're still believing it or repeating it or discussing it in good faith, you're lying to yourself. Or you're in bad faith lying to your audience. But
and
one
I
of the
just,
two.
It
no longer can be credibly brought up as something that we should take seriously, that anything can happen in the playoffs. If that's true, then why are 70% of the conference finalists the last 4 years
just
the same four
just
teams?
Just say 69 again.
69%. It's nice if you're one of those teams.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
it is.
And if you're not, man, is it hard to break in. And so...
Well, that's the perfect way to frame it, because to me, it's not even just about these final four teams, but I would expand it to include the tier of... And I know the exercise of the final four teams, but I just think there is such a clear tier one in the NHL right now, and looking back over the last 5 years, right? And it's the teams we just mentioned. The four teams playing here, Tampa, Colorado, Vegas. And so... Yeah, Colorado's lost in the first round, or has lost early this year, and hasn't gone to the conference finals again. Tampa has lost in the first round.
Errors and omissions. Brandon in Vancouver points out Dallas lost to Calgary in round one in 2002. So that's my bad. Putting my hand up, my bad.
But there's just such a clear tier one of teams, I think. And the question is not how do they get back to the playoffs for the Vancouver Canucks, because I think that path is actually relatively straightforward. And you can point to all of the things that went wrong for the team this year and bank on better health and bounce backs and all of that. And you think, okay, yeah, I can very easily see how this team gets to the playoffs. That's not the question. The question is, how do you get to the level of Vegas, Colorado, Tampa, and these final four teams. And that is a much, much bigger jump. And again, this is not a unique issue to the Canucks.
No.
Right? Like, that's what Toronto's trying to do. That's what LA's trying to do. Minnesota, you go down the list, right? Washington, there's all New Jersey. All of these teams are trying to figure out, man, how do we do that? The Canucks are further behind those teams because at least they're, like, for the most part, perennial playoff teams. But that's the... To me, that's the hardest thing to do as a team building process in hockey is make that final jump from where a team like New Jersey or Minnesota is to the true big boys.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of distance that the Canucks, who are sort of like what, somewhere in that like 14th to 18th best team in hockey range, right? And the problem is that is the range in which it is. So the range that is toughest to get to is this top one, obviously, right? The range that's easiest to get to is the bottom one.
Yes.
Because all you have to do is sell.
That's super easy.
Although, man, do some teams make it look difficult. The Canucks, though, the reason that the mushy middle is such a harsh spot to be is that it's actually the toughest to escape. Right? Like, I think because it's the one that has no gravity to it.
Mm.
If you're, you know, one of those Toronto-style contenders. I mean, how many times has Toronto won the bidding for a free agent and signed a contract that ultimately looks pretty reasonable, or had a free agent call their shot, or had a, you know, Joe Thornton or a Max Domi type, like, pick them to be a relative? Like, they're not on teams, no trade lists, right? Mikko Rantanen was willing to sign there, right? I mean, that's not a place that has, like, negative gravity pulling you back. Right? The middle is where you have negative gravity because you're not good enough to get the benefits of, hey, I can go there and win, right? And you're not bad enough to get the benefits of like high draft picks and selling at the deadline, right? And living without that like daily competitive pressure where everyone's always disappointed that you're mid, right? And so that's the biggest problem, I think, anyway. Like, I don't think the toughest nut to crack is where, like, going from where the Devils or the Maple Leafs are to that next level. I think the toughest nut to crack is going from where the Canucks are to that level that the Maple Leafs are.
To the, like, the waiting room.
Yeah, to the solid playoff
the
team.
Antechamber. It's
like the outside shot contenders.
Yeah.
You know, the dark horse tier. The dark horse tier, like, that's aspirational for the Canucks.
They'd have to
go up multiple levels. Stuck in the middle is the actual worst place to be because not only are you not catching up, but you're also being lapped by the teams behind you that are benefiting from the things that benefit bad teams.
Anyways, to bring it back to your piece at The Athletic, right? Specifically looking how they stack up with the final four teams right now. And, you know, you can talk a little bit about the process, but it's using the net rating model from The Athletic, of course, from Dom Lucision. And it's one of these exercises where I don't know if the headline is going to be super surprising, but it is really instructive to see all the data kind of laid out. But the headline is how massive the gap specifically at forward is. And that's not to say that there's no issues elsewhere, that there's no issues on the blue line that can be addressed or talent upgrades there or anything else, but specifically the top end of the forward group, when you see it all laid out, again, it's not breaking news for anybody. We all understand that, but it is really surprising and or really stunning, I should say. And I also think, and this is something I've mentioned before, but it really crystallizes a point I want to make, which is I think we've kind of fallen into the rhythm of talking about the Canucks forwards needs as, well, they need to add some top six players. They need to add two or three top six players, right? That's not true because Connor Garland and Jake DeBrusque on this exercise grade out as top six players on the final four teams.
Connor Garland grades out as a top line caliber player in league terms, but top six player on
And even Jake DeBrusque would be like, you know, fifth or sixth, but he'd be a top six guy forward on these teams.
Yeah, he could be the fourth or fifth winger.
Yeah,
or
probably
he'd probably
be the fifth best forward.
Third or fourth best winger on a contending
level. On a Stanley Cup contending team.
Like, we've seen him do that.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, we all know that.
But it's not that the Canucks need to acquire two more guys like Connor Garland and Jake DeBrusque,
no.
Right? That's two top six players. They need to acquire guys significantly above that level. They need to acquire their versions of the Rantanen, Hintz, Barkov, Reinhardt, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And so I think we're underselling it. We're underplaying it when we talk about
Jarvis.
Top six forwards.
On like the low end, we're talking Seth Jarvis.
Yeah.
You know, on the low end, we're talking, Dreisaitl, McDavid. Like, Jesus, these teams are so good, Jamie.
They're really good.
You know, and like the Canucks' best forward as it grades out in this model is Elias Pettersson. Now, Elias Pettersson used to grade out as a 16 net rating guy. So it's not like the model is blind to what's happened, but the model still rates Elias Pettersson as like a fringe elite player, right? Do we view him as a fringe elite player, or do we view him as a massive question mark?
A massive question mark.
So it's I'm just saying, in addition to all the things they need, it's like we have to start with, because I'm not projecting the Canucks to like add players. I don't like to do speculative stuff. So I've included like Pugh Suter and Brock Besser.
Mm-hmm.
Who, what do you think the odds are that both are retained? 5%?
Yeah. 1%, 2%? I don't know. Yeah. Low. Yeah, extremely low.
So it's like, I'm not even pricing in that. So we know, for example, that the Canucks are going to lose two guys. Anyone above zero, by the way, is about a top six guy. Mm-hmm. So two top six caliber forwards. We know that they're most likely to lose and will need to replace two of those guys. We also know, a priori, that Pettersson needs to bounce back for this logic, which already isn't rosy, to even begin to hold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He needs to bounce back considerably. And even if, like, so with all of that, you know, out of the way, it's like they need another elite forward to complement Pettersson, another top of the lineup, first line caliber forward at a level above that of DeBrusque, at least.
Mm-hmm. And above Besser. That of Besser.
Yeah.
Frankly.
An upgrade on those guys.
Yeah.
And then you need to replace Pugh Suter and Brock Besser. And then you probably still need another top four defenseman.
Yeah, although the gap on the top four defensemen scoring is a lot smaller than the gaps we're talking about at the top of the lineup.
Except the average of these teams have two, so above about six net rating on defense, you become considered a number one,
mm-hmm.
like a 1A defenseman. So the average team of these teams has like Seth Jones and Ekblad.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, not to mention Gustav Forsling, but yeah.
And Gustav Forsling.
Yeah.
Heiskanen
and Harley.
Bouchard and Ekholm, right? And on and on and on we go. Carolina Slavin and pick one of their other good defensemen. And the model likes Filip Hronek, but it doesn't see him as a 1A.
Mm-hmm.
It sees him as a credible top pair guy. By the way, it sees Marcus Pettersson as a fringe top pair guy. But these teams have another 1A defenseman that the Canucks are short on, and another legit top four guy, which the model does not see Myers as. The model sees him as like a fringe top four guy, which probably pretty fair.
Yeah.
I think that's how we've talked about Myers for most of his Vancouver tenure, but he certainly performed at the level of a credible top four guy this past season. But we've seen that vacillate, right? There have been years where it's like Myers, for sure. He's totally credible top four guy. And years where you've been like, Myers, you really need to find a way to shorten his minutes to get the best of him, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a 4-5, right? That's consistent with how we've often viewed him.
Yep.
The Canucks have outs there. Elias Pettersson, Tom Volander. I mean, maybe there's a guy in-house that can become that level of player. Certainly the Canucks won't prioritize like a top four guy ahead of their forward needs, given how like bright, shining light emergency situation those are. But I mean, we're talking about a team that could be short as much as four top six guys, one of whom's elite and one of whom's a first liner and an additional defender, before you're sort of at the level where the net rating model anyway would see you as being a credible contender with these four conference finalists, who, by the way, seem to make it at least every other year, if not more frequently than that.
This text came in. So in free agency terms, the Canucks would basically need Marner, Ehlers, and Bennett. Like, that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Essentially, right? And it's like, yeah, that'll be easy to do. But
that's like more or less, right? I mean, and I do think the one thing that I do think this exercise really jogs in my mind, right, is like they were short a star forward before the JT Miller trade.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And as much as the need for a top two line center is dominating the conversation locally and should, critical need, mission critical need. Just another star player.
Oh, yeah. It's to me, it's like all about talent. That's it.
Like the center can be your first line caliber guy or like a high end second line caliber guy, but you need just another star level player is absolutely essential for this team and has to be number one. Like, you're not going to close the gap. The other truth is that while I've sort of framed this as like, what do they need this offseason? You're not going to close the gap this summer. This is a multi-year project. Provided that, you know, Quinn Hughes remains in place, which is an assumption and a big one, right? But this is a multi-year project. You are probably not getting there the whole way this summer. So for me anyway, it's just like, find a way to get the most impactful guy you can. Just one, the most impactful guy you can this summer would be a huge start for this team. They need to show progress, obviously, internally. They need to show progress to their fan base. I don't care if it's a center. I don't care if it's a winger. I don't care if it's a rover. One more star contributor. That needs to be the number one goal of this offseason in my mind.
And I think the key there is as well. So let's say you do only get the one player, but you manage to land the star. The farther you go down the list of kind of the pecking order at forward, the easier it becomes to find options, right? That's just the nature of it, obviously. Yeah. It's easier to find a third line player than it is to find a first line player. It's also easier to make bets that work out. It's much easier to take a bet on an undervalued second line guy who ends up having fringe first line ability than it is to make a bet on someone to be a star. You know what I mean? That's the hardest thing to take care of. So if you're able to get that done, the rest of it becomes not easy, but easier to process, easier to handle. You have more options on how to fill the rest of the lineup out if you're able to locate that star. The problem is just trying to find the guys that are even worth talking about in terms of availability. And like, do you think, like, I don't, Marco Rossi is a popular name. He doesn't fit that bill. Do you think he has the upside to be like that star level contributor? I don't really think so.
I mean, so he's 23, so he's not really a prime aged player yet. He has 100 points in his last 162 games, two 20 goal seasons. But a lot of that production has come with, like one of the best wingers in the sport.
Yeah.
Right. So that's something that we have to bear in mind, bear in mind pretty closely here. Do I think he's got star level upside, like elite player at level upside? I probably don't love betting on that, to be totally honest with you, but he's young enough. He's been productive enough. I think we have a sense of why his progress stalled for a bit, given how complicated and long his COVID recovery was. He was one of those guys who had like a really tough time.
Yep.
So that cost him, you know, like in the 2020-2021 season, he only played one game, right? And then you can understand why it took him a while in that the next year, the 21-22 season, to sort of find his legs. But yeah, I mean, we're still talking about a guy who had 53 points in 63 games coming off a 18-month debilitating battle with long COVID in the American League, and then at 21 was a point per game guy in the American League, and then in his first full NHL season had 40 points, and in his second full NHL season had 60 points. And he's turns 24 this summer, so he's just about to enter his prime. Is there a real possibility that Marco Rossi is a caliber of player beyond what he's shown in Minnesota? Look, I don't love the bet. I wouldn't hammer the table and argue yes, but when you really go over the profile, like, maybe? You know, it's not the worst bet I've ever heard.
I think you just like it a lot more, and this is kind of what I mean, where it's like, it's so much easier to find the third best forward on the team than the second or first. You know what I mean? Like, even that gap is so much different. And if you're talking about the bet for Marco Rossi to be the third best forward on a Stanley Cup team.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like, oh, I can see that depending on who the other guys, you know, and I'm not saying he's definitely going to get there, but that's a very interesting bet.
Yeah.
If you're talking him to be part of the answer to Barkov Kachuk, it's like, well, that's a real long shot.
Yeah. I mean, those guys are both drafting the top five of their, and you know, like that's the other part of it. Draisaitl, top five pick. McDavid, number one overall pick, right? Rantanen, 10th. Rupe Hintz, wow, they did a good job on that second rounder. But yeah, like Reinhardt, Barkov, Kachuk, all top five, six picks.
Bennett was fourth, I think, wasn't he?
Bennett was fourth, yeah. And well, in the same class, like they're all the same. Yeah. Ekblad, Bennett, Draisaitl, Reinhardt, they're all the same class. And then like Carolina doesn't have those guys, and you can kind of feel it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Good point.
Like, you can kind of feel
Svechnikov
it when you watch
was
him.
second overall, I think, right? But yeah.
But that's what I'm saying, right? I mean, if they had another Svechnikov, we'd feel a little bit differently.
It's
about
a different story, probably. Yeah. So that's the real question. And again, I think there's going to be interesting names out there. Like, if Marco Rossi is out there, that's an acquisition that could make a lot of sense. But it's just, does it quite, it would be one thing if you needed two Marco Rossis.
Yeah.
That's one thing. It's tough. That's another matter, though. It's just, I
would say across,
where are they going to come from? That's my question.
Across the last two seasons, I would note that Marco Rossi has been more productive with Kirill Kaprizov, but the Wild have still outscored and controlled play in the minutes that they've spent apart. And in fact, by a number that like is a pretty close match with what they've done with Kaprizov away from Rossi. So,
all right,
small samples, but it doesn't. Yep. I like the Rossi bet. I like the Rossi bet. I think the Wild are out to lunch if they sell this guy now. And I think if the Canucks are able to elbow their way in there, I like it a fair bit. The issue, I guess, that I'd have, though, is if you're talking Rossi, Pettersson, Garland,
the size,
at some point you need a different type of player.
Yeah,
I almost like Rossi the like as a, you know, say you're doing Pettersson to Carolina, and then you're looking for two centers. You're getting like, what are you getting back from Carolina?
Jack Roslovic.
Do they have who was our other guy?
He's a UFA.
Who was our other guy?
Andrew Peak.
The rights to Roslovic and Andrew Peak again. We're doing this, but now for Pettersson. Jeez.
Can you imagine?
No, but yeah, I mean, Kotkaniemi and
sure, yeah, and then you've got the big body,
Jackson Blake.
Yeah,
something like that. I don't know. Like, I mean, if you're getting that, and then you get Rossi, I mean, I don't know. You're just treading water, man. You're just treading like this is a multi-year project.
Mm-hmm.
And just to bring it back, like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when we were talking rebuild on a daily basis on this program, the suggestion was that this team had too many needs to go about conventionally building a contender from where they were. They just had too many needs. And I actually think the execution to try to make that work was decent. I think it obviously short-circuited as a result of the personalities involved, which is galling. And Canucks fans should be damn angry about it. I know Canucks brasses. But I actually think they got just about as close as it was reasonable to expect them to get to actually patching it together and making it work, given the like completely crumbled foundation that Rutherford and Alvin took over. I think they did an amazing job being as efficient as possible without taking an intentional step back and spending a couple of years accumulating. But I don't know that there's a way forward now. Like, I don't know how you actually get to the level that these contending teams are at from where the Canucks are at now, especially when you sort of start the ticking clock on the Quinn Hughes question and throw that dynamic on.
Well, especially if you feel like you have to do it in an expedited way, right?
Yeah.
All right, we'll take a break here.
Best of luck to them.
I'm excited.
I'll be honest.
I'm excited to watch them try.
I'm not even mad anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not even mad in doing the Canucks fans deserve better thing. Like, just good luck to them. This is a circus trick now.
It's going
to
be entertaining.
Yeah.
All right.
Is it?
Oh, maybe.
I mean, we'll have fun.
650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We'll take a break. Dmitry Filipovich from the Hockey PDO cast joins us in studio next here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650, Dunbar, Lumber, text line. And we're now joined in studio on a very special occasion here by our good pal, Dmitry Filipovich, host of the Hockey PDO cast, which you can hear on the Sportsnet Radio Network. And I say it's very special because you've brought a guest in today, Dmitry, your dog Joe.
Yes,
correct?
Joey. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's just bring your kid to work day.
And he is like, most dogs are cute. This is at another level.
He's a very handsome guy.
This is an incredibly cute dog.
He's behind the glass right now pushing the button, so if you hear weird weird audio,
he is sitting just like so placidly and calmly in producer Lena's lap, and she looks so delighted with her life right now.
Best Friday ever. I'm gonna put a headset on.
We got an audience. Yes, this is incredible.
Yeah, we need to see that.
Joe is just calmly observing the show from back there.
I better make sure Wallace doesn't get to hear this.
He's gonna be like, why didn't I get to come in?
Yeah, it's like, because you're annoying, man.
Like, Joey's you're so, not as cool as Joe.
No, it's Joey's. It's more that Joey's much calmer than Wallace.
Well, Wally's been on my show many times barking in the back.
In the background.
With squeaky toys.
Because when we're hanging out, he's like, and we're going to play now, right? So he's not as placid as Joe. Joe's much chiller.
One would say their dogs mirror the owner.
That's an interesting point there, actually. One's very calm, the other one's very high strung. Interesting.
Is that me and Dean? Is that our dynamic?
You're just discovering this?
Seems like a stretch.
Well, we're glad that Joey is here to join us. And I got to say, as the chief Carolina Hurricanes hater in the hockey world.
Yes.
Are you enjoying it right now? Are you enjoying life right now, especially after that game 2 result last night?
I mean, I wish the games were more entertaining, especially when you compare it to what we're seeing from the West final. But yeah, I think especially that game 2, right? Game 1 was much more competitive and the Hurricanes had some chances early on and weren't able to convert. That was just as thorough a demolishment as you're going to see, especially in this setting, right? You lose game 1 at home. Mm-hmm. You're thinking, all right, there's going to be an added layer of urgency. This team's going to be desperate. They're going to come out of the gate. And the Panthers score 70 seconds in. And from that point on, it was just a defensive masterclass. I had them down for 6 scoring chances the entire game, the Hurricanes, which is almost impossible to do. I think Sportlogic had them at 0.74 expected goals for the game, which was the first time below 1 all postseason for any team. So, yeah, it was kind of all of our fears playing out in real time. Now, I'm choosing to give the Panthers credit. I think they're an amazing team.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to make it back for their third straight Stanley Cup final appearance. And really, they're tightening the screws and playing peak Panthers hockey and just demolishing them.
They've hit another level here, starting with that Game 5 win against the Leafs.
22-4 goal differential in their past 4 road games. Yeah.
And I think the thing last night, too, was their first 2 goals in particular. Like, it's one thing to give up an opening goal. It's like, oh, you know, lucky shot from the point or bad deflection or whatever.
Yeah, got tipped in Orlov, yeah.
Those were, like, identity goals, right? It was just, like, relentless forechecking pressure, forcing a mistake, and then, boom, it's in the back of your neck. Like, they could not have done a better job of coming out, putting their stamp on the game, and saying, like, hey, Carolina, we know you're the ultimate identity team and you have your system, but we're actually better at it than you. We do it better than you.
There's also something so impressive about what they do to you as an opponent where they get you feeling like you need to match their physicality.
Yes.
So to you know, not get punked by them and play their game, and then you'd gravitate further from what actually got you to this position to begin with. You see that retaliatory penalty Svechnikov took winds up being 3-0 in the first, which was very sloppy. They're just kind of chasing them around, trying to hit them and prove that they belong in the series.
Mm-hmm.
And the Panthers are like, you're not going to do this better than we do, so please keep trying. And instead, we're just going to keep scoring goals.
It feels, not to cross sports here, but it feels a little bit like the Western Conference Finals in the NBA, where Minnesota's just like, oh, you guys are just better than us. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To the Thunder. It's like, dang it. That's really frustrating to go against.
And and Shea getting every call is like Sam Bennett never being penalized for his suspect
in game 1 when the Sportsnet broadcast ran a mixtape of him injuring people. It was wild.
Canadian hero Sam Bennett. Look at him out there.
Hey,
taking guys' heads off.
He can use his elbow and his shoulder.
I mean, there's a value to being one of the players that referees just have decided is allowed to defend. We see it in more benign ways with like JT Miller and Filip Hronek in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that Sam Bennett's like the guy who's allowed to, I don't want to use a term like headshots, but throw real borderline hits without being called on it for some reason.
Well, speaking of also, because I know you've made the point about the Canucks and their love of the subtle interference through neutral zone. I think it was Mike Kelly who had like the mixtape of Florida setting the picks on the Carolina players going in for the forecheck. Every time they dump it in, it's like, I'm just going to skate in front of you here and slow you down.
I legitimately think if there's one thing that the league needs to crack down on and like really think about cracking down on more than anything else, it's that. Simply because I think it... Now there's an element to which I suppose you want to avoid like really high impact collisions for player safety reasons. So there's probably a balance that has to be struck, but forechecking, allowing teams to forecheck without blockers basically creates turnovers, places an additional emphasis on speed, will amp up the number of mistakes in the game and make it more fun to watch. Like, I think nothing is slowing down the game more than that. And the more teams do it, get away with it and make it work, the more you're going to see copycat teams. And I just fear that it's like the biggest risk we have going in terms of what could result in a new dead puck era.
I agree. It's a tough thing to come down on as an official because a lot of it like there's a couple instances where they're pretty egregious where like they just take down F1 and you're like, all right, if the guy falls down to the ice, that probably should just be an interference penalty. A lot of them are very borderline in isolation where it's like this one event is like the timing of it, whether it was a couple milliseconds late or not, so you just let it go.
And there's
then
like,
it accumulates.
There's always like a
series.
Plausible deniability thing too, right?
Yeah, kinda, you're standing there. Yeah, I'm entitled to this ice as much as the forechecker, and so I'm just going to stand here and kind of get in his way. It's a really tough thing to crack down on. I mean, they have a very nice feel for what the officials are going to call, especially once you get to these later stages of the postseason and they're playing within the NHL's rule book. But I can see why it would be incredibly frustrating for a team playing them because you essentially have to try to do that yourself. Otherwise, it's just going to be such a massive advantage.
Yeah, you can't just voluntarily give them the advantage and be like, well, we're going to follow the rules. It's like, no, you got to get down in the muck a little
bit. Yeah, there's an evil genius to what they do for sure.
There definitely is. So, I mean, I think, first of all, I think you're totally right that the number one story for me through the first two games of the Eastern Conference Finals is not Carolina related. It's how good Florida is. Yep. It's just the level that Florida is. Now, having said that, I understand, given their history at this stage of the playoffs and the general conversation around Carolina, I get why we're all going to focus on their faults and what they do wrong and all of that. The funny thing is, though, and Drance and I touched on this a little bit earlier in the show, it's like, the whole hockey world is yelling at them like, oh, see, it doesn't work. You need to do this. And they're like, yeah, we know. We're trying.
Yes, yeah.
You know what I mean? So I almost don't know. We have people texting like, oh, are they going to fire Rod Brindamore? Like, I don't think so, man. Like, what are they going to do different? It's like, I think it's going to be more of the same. They're going to try to wait for the next Mikko Rantanen to come available and try to get him and hope that he stays this time.
And they're pretty well positioned to do so. They have a ton of cap space. They have a bunch of extra draft picks that they got from the Stars to go along with all these prospects that they've accumulated themselves over the past couple of years. So they're pretty well positioned to, whether it's via trade or free agency, go out and get one of those guys. I'm with you, though. Like, I think they have very clearly acknowledged all of our concerns with the Gensel trade last year, with going out and trying to get Rantanen. I think they're well aware of the limitations of the way they play. I imagine, when they made that second Rantanen trade and sent it to Dallas, there was an acknowledgement that this might be a bit of a step back here for us to play the long game and regroup in the offseason. Then they blow through two pretty inferior opponents in Washington and New Jersey, and I think there's an inflated expectation all of a sudden, like, all right, well, now they're playing so well, they won both in five, and this was kind of an inevitability, I think, the entire way. So it shouldn't come as a surprise, yet I think watching just how bleak game two was distorts that a little bit, because it's like there's losing, and then there's just
having your soul ripped
out. Seven shots on goal through two periods.
Yeah.
And your fan base chanting for you to shoot.
Yeah.
Which I never thought I'd see.
Which you're like the team that needs the least help, least encouragement usually to shoot.
They just never had the puck in good positions. It was wild.
Yeah. That's tough. It's tough to come back from that, I think. We'll see. We'll see what they ultimately end up doing. On the Florida side, I mean, we're raving about them. I did think it was funny. Was it Taylor Hall to Greg Wyshynski who was like, look, they're not perfect. The Leafs took them to game seven.
Yeah, so the Leafs are sitting at home. But come on, man.
I loved that quote.
We're golfing.
Like,
leave
that
us
team
alone.
Took them to game seven.
If the Leafs could do it.
So it's probably not going to be Carolina, but whether it's Edmonton or Dallas in the Western Conference Final, like, what do teams need to do? What's the shred of hope against this Florida juggernaut right now?
I mean, I know Tom made this point to me, so I'm going to steal a little bit here, but I feel like the Leafs put out a pretty good template, obviously, as the series progressed.
I'm actually annoyed that the Panthers have dog-walked the Carolina Hurricanes so significantly in the first two games that now everyone's got this take. I thought this was going to be a more unique take when we were talking about it 48 hours ago. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, I mean, just kind of leveraging that over-aggression on the forecheck and creating odd man rush opportunities, particularly in the first two games of that round two series. There were just so many instances where they did that and scored a bunch of goals on Bobrovsky and then failed to do so as the series progressed, especially in those last two home games. But that is the blueprint. Mm-hmm. Certainly it's easier said than done, especially as the series progresses, because I think there's like a bit of an accumulation of just how difficult they are to play against, and knowing you're going to get hit every time and just how relentless that pressure is, you're going to start making mistakes. But we saw the Oilers, when they made their comeback last year and won those three straight games, kind of do a very similar thing of just all these odd man rush opportunities every time they got caught deep. Both the Oilers and the Stars have the forwards to do that again. And so I think a Stanley Cup final against either would be incredibly fun. But I feel like, you know, we're owed a rematch considering how tight that series was last year of Oilers Panthers, and kind of seeing those, like, the best offensive team with McDavid and Draisaitl at their very best against the best defensive team, and seeing who wins.
Well, and it does feel like the answer to how do you counter Florida, the best answer is have Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, right? Like, that ultimately is going to be just you're not going to beat them from a team-wide perspective, from a systems perspective, anything like that. So have the individual players most capable of breaking the game open.
And, you know, in Dreisaitl's defense last year, he was clearly hanging on by a thread physically as that series progressed and just didn't have anything left in the tank. I do worry, like, some of the guys that really excelled in that environment, you think of what Dylan Holloway was doing and Philip Broberg's contributions and Ryan McLeod, and removing those guys, the Oilers are still an incredibly good team as we're seeing this postseason. But in that particular matchup, some of those strengths that they leveraged in winning those three straight games from Game 4 to Game 6, it'll be a bit more difficult, I think. They're a bit more methodical in terms of the way they attack. So Florida would probably – and listen, Florida, it's crazy to say this about a team that just won the Cup, has made it to two straight finals. You'd think they'd be fatigued at this point. I feel like this version of the Panthers is far superior to last year's version, just because like, you watch what Seth Jones did in that Game 7 against Toronto when he was the best player on the ice.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I know Montour was phenomenal for them last year, but it feels like this year's version is even better than the one that won the Cup last year.
Well, and especially you look at, like, with the what their third line is doing now, right, is absolutely outrageous with Brad Marchand there. So you're right. It feels kind of crazy to say, but they might be the best iteration of the Panthers we've seen yet. Drance?
Yeah.
Drance is firing off some fantasy football trade proposals there.
He's texting Wallace. He's like, please don't be upset that you're not in studio.
I'm so sorry, buddy. Yeah. The thing about Carolina, and we saw them do this with Mikko Rantanen, like, they put their chips on the table. They think that they need to play this style of hockey, but with far better players, if they're going to actually break through. I do think that the Panthers, given their, like, I think it's fair to say that Rod Brind'Amour is not tactically malleable, right? That he wants to play one way and he doesn't seem to adjust the way, like, a guy like Craig Berube is more comfortable doing. That said, the way Rod Brind'Amour plays gives your team a higher gear than the way that Craig Berube does. So it's not like it's trade-offs more than it's one is better than the other. But the truth is I don't know that Paul Maurice is all that tactically malleable either. I think the Florida Panthers are just doing what the Carolina Hurricanes want to be doing, where they're playing this stress hockey but with the talent to really make it pop.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, I think Paul Maurice has done an unbelievable job just in terms of the consistency with which the Panthers operate, and then the buy-in from everyone who comes in to play that way, even though a lot of these guys never really showed this was in their bag in previous stops, and they come in and they just fit in and they get the most out of those guys. I think that's a testament to them. And yeah, I think what they're doing right now is just incredible. I mean, it's going to take a lot to beat them.
I brought this up earlier in the week, but I thought Nate Schmidt actually had a really fascinating quote to Eric Engels about beating the Carolina forecheck, which they've done really well so far, obviously, and how, like, there's no one trick. You just have to read, but the whole team has to make the right read and do it, and Florida's just so good at doing it. Like, they're the most on the same page team, it seems like, in the NHL, maybe the most well-coached team in the NHL right now. And you're right. It's like Dran says, like, there's maybe not a lot of tactical change, but what they do, they do the better than anybody.
Well, it's an interesting spot because on the one hand, I think everyone's just going to point to the tax breaks and the sunshine and be like, this is why it's a desirable destination. But beyond just winning, they've proven now that if you're a guy who just got bought out or is coming off a bad year, rather than signing long term for less than you think you're worth, rebuilding your value by coming in, playing a role on this team, looking as the best version as you ever have, and then cashing in after, is going to be an interesting sort of selling point for them. We've already seen with all the interviews Matthew Tkachuk does, I know people took it as like he's making fun of the Leafs or whatever, but I think it was actually
a sales pitch.
A very interesting sales pitch of being like, this could be you. Come hang out, win a lot, play very well.
Do you like the sunshine? Do you like winning Stanley Cups?
Yeah. Do you like just getting to skate forward all the time and having the puck? It's pretty fun.
Getting to skate forward all the time. That's great.
Nate Schmidt's like, yes, I do.
That's exactly what I want.
Yeah, well, and so the Nate Schmidt thing of this too, like, there's a dumpster diving element to this sort of Panthers run that I don't think we should overlook. Like, no one targets more consistently anyone who's bought out than the Florida Panthers. They always have a bought out guy.
Them in Dallas.
Yeah, well, Duchesne is like the perfect example. But I mean, Oliver Ekman-Larsson, Nate Schmidt, they had one in that President's Trophy winning year too. I can't remember exactly who it was.
Alex Wenberg.
At Wenberg. They also had, who was the guy that Ottawa bought out? Young guy, Colin Miller or whatever.
Oh, Colin White.
Colin White.
Yeah.
And then Colin Miller. And Bockvist.
Yep.
So like they're always dumpster diving, and they do it tremendous job fleshing out the roster. Nico Mikkola. Can we talk about the Nico Mikkola glow up?
That goal he set up was one of the most incredible physical feats I've ever seen on the ice. I was saying, he goes 10-2 behind his net, gets it up the wall, sprints up the ice, beats everyone, starts demanding the puck, calling a shot, gets it back, and then goes backhand and sets up
Jake
Greer perfectly. It was incredible.
You know who Nico Mikkola is, by the way? I had this thought while watching that goal, and it occurred to me that there is a Canucks defenseman from the last 15 years, much maligned, who would have been like an ace second pair guy for the Florida Panthers, who like absolutely could barely play a shift here. Do you want to hazard a guess?
Nikita Triamkin?
No, it's not Nikita Triamkin. You ready for this?
Yeah.
It's Lucas Spezza.
Oh, wow.
Lucas Spezza with that speed and just like absolute chaotic game. He's basically Nico Mikkola.
Yeah. They target guys with
slightly better puck skills.
Yes. Yeah. I feel like to play in that way, like you do less, but you have to do it efficiently.
Yeah.
And all the pizzas he was throwing around the ice, I feel like they wouldn't tolerate it. I mean, you see with Boquist, like he didn't last long in that lineup there for them. So,
first, what do you expect to see game two tonight, Western Conference Finals?
Oh, it's going to be a fun one. I thought game one was incredible that first period, especially after watching game one of these final the night before, and it's like nothing's happening for large stretches. And then that first period, I think they had 19 combined scoring chances between the two. I'm like, yes, please.
Yes,
7 games.
This is what we're looking for.
I thought it was really fun. You saw why both teams got to this point, why they're both so good in the 5-on-5 play from the Oilers the first 40 minutes and all the chances Draisaitl and McDavid are creating. And then I thought Jake Oettinger was good yet again, and the power play for the Stars has been incredible this postseason, and it's the second unit doing it for them. And is it really a second unit when Miro Heiskanen, Jason Roberts, and Michael Granlund and Tyler Seguin are on it? That's a lot of teams' first unit, and so I expect more of the same. I think the Stars will certainly play better than they did in the first 40 minutes, but I feel like the Oilers got to feel good about their game as long as they don't take a lot of the dumb penalties they took in the third.
I wanted to ask you again, away from the playoffs right now, but of course we're all talking about forwards the Canucks can target this offseason. One name that has come up a lot is Marco Rossi out of Minnesota. What do you think about, not even just necessarily as a fit for the Canucks, but any team looking to potentially take a bet on Marco Rossi? What are your thoughts on the play?
Yeah, I really like Rossi's game. Obviously, like, you need to apply the context in terms of the slow start to his career with him getting ill during COVID and kind of having to take a year off essentially and rework his game. I thought he's put a ton of work into it. I thought he was awesome this year, especially with all the injuries they had up front. He was playing a top line center role for them and looking the part. I'm not sure he's necessarily a number one center, but I don't think the acquisition cost is going to reflect that. And so if he's your second line center playing with other skilled players, he can certainly contribute a ton. I'm very surprised that it's played out this way. It's been kind of a slow burn in terms of just reading all the quotes coming out of Minnesota from Bill Guerin and everyone involved. Like, this has been a long time coming, and I don't really get it because I haven't seen anything either statistically or on the tape to suggest that they shouldn't be happy with him. But obviously the fit just hasn't been there.
Wasn't he like the ninth overall pick too? Like,
yeah, I mean, if you want to enjoy, if you got 7 minutes to kill, go on YouTube, type in Marco Rossi OHL highlights. He was incredible. Like, he was just a bowling ball. Just, I know people in the draft process are always like, I don't know, this guy's pretty short. What's it going to look like? And then you watched him play in the OHL, and he was just living around the net and causing havoc at all times. And it's translated to the NHL, and he's just a really fun player.
I think there's this perception that he doesn't necessarily have star ceiling, but I don't know if that's right. I mean, this is a guy who's been productive on his own two feet in addition to what he's been able to do with Kaprizov. Yeah, he's not the biggest guy, but 40 points as a 22-year-old, 60 as a 23-year-old. We know that he had some development time lost to like an 18-month catastrophic battle with long COVID. I mean, I don't know. This is a pre-prime player. Like, I think there could be another breakout.
I don't
another
know that
level
you're going to, like, if you're just looking for the boxes you want checked in a potential acquisition of, like, age, position, draft pedigree.
Yep.
And, like, it's like draft pedigree, and it's not like he's been bad. He had 60 points last year. You know what I mean? So it's not like you're like, well, he was the eighth overall pick, but he hasn't established himself as an NHLer yet. Like, he has.
Yeah, it's not just floor, though, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, there is floor, but
I think but the draft pedigree is part of what gives you the ceiling
too,
right?
I think there might be more ceiling than we're discussing in terms of looking back at this 2 years ago. If the Wild are keen to make a mistake here, I think the Canucks, among a variety of other NHL teams, should be lining up to benefit.
All right. Dim, before we let you go, what's going on in the hockey PDOcast these days?
I just did a show with Steve Peters, former employee,
nice.
Video coach of the Arizona Coyotes. We broke down everything we've been seeing from the Panthers Hurricanes. So a lot of what we talked about earlier today, just taking to the
with someone smarter,
breaking it all down, all the X's and O's, kind of getting into what the Panthers are doing, what the Hurricanes aren't doing. So, yeah, we're going to do that. And then I know you guys are having Harmon on here after me. He'll be on my show tomorrow,
there
breaking down the Game 2 of the West Final.
Awesome. All right. That is Dmitry Filipovich. Again, you can check out the Hockey PDOcast across the Sportsnet Radio Network. We'll take a break. Final segment of the week next. Harmon Dial from The Athletic joins us here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Guitar Hero
that is some guitar noodling right there. You love to hear it on a Friday afternoon. That's what all sports radio should sound like, really.
Truly. I don't know why we never
the
do.
The classic sound of sports radio right there.
It really is. Now we just need that, we need you to adopt that, the Jayhawk.
Yes.
and then we're cooking.
Oh, man. Someone had a really funny one.
This is peak Jayhawk.
Peak Jayhawk. It's time for Rock Chalk Jayhawk. Let's go. Rock Chalk Jayhawk. Rock Chalk.
I like
else.
Rock Chalk Jayhawk,
that's actually
too.
Not bad, actually. Yeah. That's interesting. It is Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz.
Jayhawk always busting balls. Rock Jock Jayhawk.
Classic Jayhawk. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. And now joining us to wrap up the week here on
the Jayhawk Hotline.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, by the way, guests, thank you for reminding me. Guests on Sportsnet 650, call in on the hotline powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. Joining us now on the hotline from The Athletic, he is Harmon Dial. Harmon, what's going on, man? Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me. I'm doing great.
So I wanted, before we get to maybe some playoff stuff and the Vancouver Canucks themselves, I wanted to start with the Abbotsford Canucks. They've got a chance to move on to the Western Conference Finals of the Calder Cup playoffs. They'll have a couple chances, actually. First tonight, and then if they can't get it done tonight, they'll play on Monday, I believe, against Colorado in a winner-take-all Game 5. And I know you had a piece up at The Athletic earlier this week looking at some of the players of interest for Abbotsford. From the perspective of next year's version of the Vancouver Canucks, what do you think has been the most notable development or story from these Calder Cup playoffs so far?
Yeah, it's been encouraging to see Victor Mancini really take a step in the American League. To me, he's been Abbotsford's clear-cut best defenseman. He's deployed like their number one in all situations, just logging a ton of huge minutes. We know that his size and skating are always going to be a major asset, but it's been encouraging. Like, the biggest difference I've noticed between when we saw him in the NHL, particularly towards the end of the season, compared to down in Abbotsford lately, is his level of composure and poise with the puck. It sort of felt like when we saw him in the NHL, and especially when he got a late-season cameo with Quinn Hughes, he would sometimes seem a little bit sporadic as far as adjusting to the pace of play, not from his skating, obviously, but just his reads and making plays under pressure, just situations where, let's say, he gets an awkward pass in his feet and there's a forechecker bearing down on him, some of those puck touches in the defensive zone, some of his reads as far as when to step up and ensuring that he's not getting caught out of position. It just seemed like from a pace perspective, there was some adjusting to do, whereas in the American League, you can really see, and I think part of this is his confidence is oozing as well, but some of those similar situations where, let's say on the breakout, he's under a lot of duress. It's not just that he's engineering breakouts because he's just faster than everybody. It's been a level of poise and comfort under duress to problem solve different scenarios. And that part is really encouraging to me. Of course, it's been nice to see him really dictating offensively lately, 3 points so far in the Colorado series, but also defensively. He's been a huge part of their elite PK, just taking away a lot of those crossing passing lanes, backdoor things. And so his decision-making has been really polished, and he's just been an all-around workhorse, all-around star for them. So that's been nice to see.
What were your thoughts? Like, I was pretty concerned with what I saw down the stretch at the NHL level, Harmon. I know we discussed it a little bit. Has he opened your eyes? Like, has he changed your mind in any way or influenced your thinking about sort of his ceiling or where he could fit into Vancouver's plans this offseason?
Yeah, and to be totally honest with you, I was also concerned with what I saw down the stretch. I sort of looked at him and went, the athleticism is there, but I don't know if the hockey IQ necessarily...
Yeah, felt a little Tucker Pullman, right? Like, big, yeah, can move well, but, you know, tools, maybe not the toolbox.
Exactly. And so, like, it's tough to evaluate in the spot because, on the one hand, the AHL is played at a slower speed, right? And we've seen guys go down there, be stars in the AHL, and for whatever reason, when it comes to taking that next step in the NHL, they're not able to quite capitalize. But then there's another way of potentially looking at it where, again, it does seem like at that level, he is making sharper decisions. Like, he's not making mistakes, even in spots where, like, sometimes when defensemen are trying to make a lot of things happen, they're really dictating offensively with zone exits. You sort of expect them to make mistakes, to occasionally sort of turn the puck over, and that's where he's been so really, really polished. And I don't think he's dominating solely off his physical tools. They're obviously his best asset down in the American League right now, but I do think there's, like, part of me wonders if maybe it's just a case of, can he build the confidence now in the American League, carry that over into training camp, and then is it just a matter of getting more reps in at the NHL level? And once you are able to become more accustomed to it, more comfortable, then the game starts to slow down for you a little bit. Like, that's the best way I can describe Mancini in the AHL right now, is it feels like the game slowed down for him. But I can't tell right now whether it's because it's the AHL pace is just slower, and if you put him back in an NHL environment, you might see some of those same seams exposed, or whether the game slowed down for him because he's developing in the right way and his confidence is on a high note. So I think that's something that I'll have a better grasp on come training camp and once we see him against NHL peers.
Is part of this, do you think, just a reps thing for Mancini? Or because, you know, he's 22, he's going to turn 23 in just a few days, actually. So he's not especially young for a prospect, but he only turned pro at the end of last season, had a bit of a cameo in the AHL, played in the playoffs, and then this has been his first full pro season. And just doing the quick math on HockeyDB, I think he's still at like 85-ish pro game. So not that much yet. Do you think that's part of this? Is just, hey, this was his first full pro season, and there's going to be some reps for him to see if he can iron out some of these problems?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that definitely is a possibility. And it was interesting, too. Like, we had him on our show a week or 2 weeks ago. And one thing that he sort of was speaking glowingly about was even just some of the conversations he's had with Manny Malhotra to sort of hone in on sort of game management and refine his decision making with the puck and sort of understanding and sort of developing that sense of when is the right moment to search for specific plays. And he even spoke about how in some spots when you're under duress as a defenseman, like you just kind of got to live the fight another day and occasionally go glassing out, even if it's not the ideal play, you're cutting down on the number of mistakes you're making. And I think for him to take the next step in the NHL, sort of what we saw down the stretch was, okay, it was mistake prone. It was a little sporadic. So if he can really understand picking his spots a little bit better and reading the play at a quicker level, like, that's going to be the key, because we already know he has the physical tools. It's developing the sort of sense and the reads and making sure that he's a polished two-way player that coaches can trust at the NHL level.
Harmon, a lot of talk about sticker shock or Sam Bennett at $10 million or Mitch Marner at, would you go over 12 for Mitch Marner, and on and on. We've been talking on this show a little bit about the idea of sort of what changes will rot at the end of the flat cap era in terms of how we should be looking at and thinking about sort of player valuations relative to where we've been over the past few years. Do you have sort of a take on where we're heading and how we have to think about what's next for sort of the hockey business here?
Yeah, I do think there is, like, and across the board, right? Not just necessarily with some of the potential top UFAs, but even look at a player like Matt Coronato in Calgary, who, you know, sort of, he's essentially, you know, similar to Lekkomäki in a sense, you know, mid first round pick, year older, obviously. Coronato had sort of like a year ago had a year similar to Lekkomäki right now, where, you know, really played really well in the AHL, wasn't quite productive in the NHL. And then this past season, Coronato broke out with sort of 24 goals and almost 50 points. So, you know, one good year, and he's a $6.5 million player on a long-term deal. And so you may initially look at that and go, oh, well, like $6.5 million already. He's not even sort of that proven. He only really did it once. But then I look at a deal like that and consider, you know, his age, his upside, already scoring 24 goals at that age. And I look at that and go, like, that's a pretty good contract. I like that bet for the Flames. Even though on the surface, that sounds like, whoa, you're already paying a guy like that $6.5 million. So I think we're going to have to adjust our thinking on what sort of cap hits coincide with, you know, different players around the league. Like even a guy like Neil Pionk, who he had a really good season this year playing with Dylan Sandberg. But previously, a lot of Jets fans were looking at his $5.8 million cap hit and going, you know, that he's overpaid. Like that's expensive. He's not quite a $5.5+ million defenseman, and now he signs a long term sort of deal that is going to pay him $7 million on his next contract. So you're going to see that inflation, and I do think it helps teams that already have a lot of their sort of core guys locked up long term. I think that's an advantage if you're like it's a little bit harder for a team like moving forward, let's say like the Dallas Stars, who they still have to sign a lot of their you know, big name players over the next, you know, two or three seasons. So if you have cost certainty among, you know, a lot of your core players, that's really helpful, because I think you're going to see quite a bit of inflation with these next contracts.
Yeah, and I do wonder if one of the dynamics we'll see this summer, because it's the cap space, but then also the lack of options on the UFA market, is that we're so used to players with term left on their deals being very difficult to move, just not teams not having interest in acquiring term. But if I wonder if players who signed long-term deals at the tail end of the cap of the flat cap era will all of a sudden become pretty desirable trade assets. And, you know, I don't know if there's a way for the Canucks to capitalize on that, but obviously like Filip Hronek falls into that category. You know, Bo Horvat with the Islanders is another player who falls on that category, where all of a sudden their numbers look entirely different than they did when they signed the deal, and teams could be really motivated to try to acquire those types of guys.
Yeah, and I think an interesting litmus test for this type of situation is going to be a guy like Owen Tippett, who in Philadelphia, they, of course, have Michkov and Konechny, and they sort of have the surplus of talented wingers. And you look at Tippett, he signed for quite a while at a $6.2 million cap hit. He's coming off a down year where he only had 20 goals, but the previous two seasons he had 28 goals and then 27 goals. So he's been sort of a, you know, high 20 goal scorer. Normally you would look at, I think, that type of contract for a non-star winger, and it would be pretty undesirable. Like, yep. I don't think there'd be a lot of teams that would be willing to pay a lot for an Owen Tippett. And so I look at a player like that who, you know, is 26 years old, has 25+ goal upside, is locked up long-term at $6.2 million. And I wonder if teams will look at a contract like that differently. And so if Philly dangles a player like Tippett in the offseason because they want to open up cap space to address other needs or just bring value back in because, you know, he's coming off a down year. I wonder if the trade market for a player like him looks differently than it would have, let's say, a year ago.
Yeah, that's a great name there. I think that's a very interesting one to monitor. Just before we move on from Abbotsford entirely, anyone else who's really caught your eye watching these Abbotsford Canucks games?
Yeah, I mean, Shelovs has been excellent. I think it's encouraging that over the last couple of games. Jonathan Lekkermäki is starting to sort of ramp up and really hit his stride. It was obviously a tough start for him, not only in these playoffs and then, you know, missing three games or so because of complications from his dental procedure, but also when he was sent down, he went pointless in his last four regular season games too. So it had been about combined, I think, heading into the Colorado series, eight games where he hadn't scored a goal down there in Abbotsford. And game one of that series, you were a little bit sort of concerned. He largely looked uninvolved, and those, not just production-wise, he wasn't driving play, but I think in game two, he finally scored off a rebound, and then you could start to see the confidence really growing. He's got 4 points in his last two games, and more important than that, he's actually driving play now. With his own entries, with the plays he's seeing, even in the third period he of game three, he rang a shot off the crossbar. So to see him start to figure things out again and be involved, be impactful on that Abbey top line is a really encouraging sign, because I think the pressure was starting to ramp up for him a little bit.
On Lekkermäki, I mean, we've talked so much about what the Canucks need to add to their top six mix for next year. How reasonable is it to expect him to be part of that solution, right? Not to be a star player necessarily, but to be a guy who can stick in the top six and help address what we assume was going to be, you know, the goal scoring issues for the Canucks. Certainly they had those this year. Can he be part of that solution in the top six as early as next season?
I don't know about top six full-time necessarily. I mean, if he does it, great. I mean, certainly we saw Coronado do something similar, but that's probably best case scenario, if we're being honest. I think he absolutely should be part of the mix in some capacity. But the way I'd sort of be looking at Lekkermäki is almost like, you know, third line, you know, probably needs to be sheltered. Probably not in your top six opening night, because the thing to keep in mind too is you're going to face injuries. And so if you're a team that, you know, game one of the regular season, you're already leaning on Lekkermäki in your top six, unless it's the scenario, of course, where he's blown training camp out of the water, has dominated preseason, and you're like, whoa, this guy's taking a huge step. Barring that type of scenario, if he's in your top six game one of the regular season, that's a little bit worrying, because what's going to happen in January or February when you're banged up? You're going to have to rely even more heavily on him. And so ideally he'd be part of your middle six. And yeah, I could see him, you know, being ready for spot duties in the top six role. But ideally, if it's like game one of the regular season, I'd prefer to see him, yes, in the NHL lineup somewhere, presuming he's had a strong training camp. But I probably wouldn't want to lean on him as a full-time, everyday top six player, just because you expect there to be, you know, potential bumps in the road. And I'm always of the mindset that when you're building a team, you'd rather keep your expectations in check for young prospects and then be positively surprised, as opposed to already baking in really optimistic expectations for how young prospects are going to fit in.
Harmon, with what we published today at The Athletic, looking at the Canucks and contrasting them with the sort of four semifinalists, you know, one of the main takeaways that I sort of took from that exercise was, forget about the center. The number one goal has to be to find an elite player. Like, the best player that you can graft onto this roster who is a forward. I don't care if he's a left winger. I don't care if he's a right winger. I don't care if he's 6'5". I don't care if he's 5'9". Just the best possible player you can land. What do you think of that analysis?
I fully agree, because even if you have a scenario where Pettersson bounces back, you look at, you know, teams like Edmonton and Florida, Dallas, they all have other sort of elite difference makers. And so it isn't just a case of, if you find a quality second line center behind Elias Pettersson that and another, let's say, second line caliber winger, that all of a sudden your top six woes are solved. And so really too, it's interesting to look at the teams that are left here and just understanding how deep they are up front relative to, like, these teams don't have spectacular blue lines. The Edmonton Oilers are doing this, like, even when Matthias Ekholm is sort of healthy, you look at that, you know, blue line and go, like, it's good, but it's not elite. And you remove Ekholm from that equation, and you obviously have good players, you know, Bouchard, Wallman, you know, Nurse has been a bit better, but it's not a great blue line, let's be honest. They're powered by their forward group. And not just, you know, McDavid and Drysdale, but the improved depth of that lineup too. You look at the Dallas Stars, and yeah, sure, when Heiskanen is, you know, he's been back in the lineup, like, that's a strong top three, but they're not the deepest blue line, especially on that right side, and they beat Colorado in the first round without Heiskanen. They've done it on the back of, you know, their forward group and Rantanen being such a difference maker. The Florida Panthers, that forward group is menacing. The blue line, yeah, it's contributed offense in these playoffs, but Florida's just has an environment where their defensemen are greater than the sum of their parts, right? Like Nico Mikkola, perfect example. He was a number of six defenseman before he got to Florida. He just pops. And you can still, they're still finding ways to win with a guy like that. I mean, we know the Forsling story being a waiver wire and getting the most out of him. And just like constantly rehabilitating guys like Nate Schmidt this year and OEL last year. You know, in years past, no one would look at Florida's blue line as, oh, this is an elite group, but we all look at their forward group and the luxury of being able to throw Lundell and Marchand on your third line and the star power of Tkachuk, Barkov, and Reinhardt, and Draghi. It's like, that's your superpower. And so even when you look at why a team like Carolina is sort of finding it tough to hang in the Eastern Conference Final, it's because up front they don't have enough of those elite star-level contributors at the forward position, right? I think if you just looked around at all 32 teams and were sort of to rank their forward groups, Dallas, Edmonton, and Florida, the three best teams with a chance to win a Stanley Cup right now, they would all probably rank top five. Whereas if you had those same conversations strictly for the blue line, I don't know that they'd necessarily rank as highly, especially when you consider what Dallas and Edmonton has done, considering the injuries that, you know, they dealt with Heiskanen for round one, and Edmonton hasn't had Ekholm either. So yeah, I think whatever you can do to add as much sort of high ceiling talent to your forward group is essential. And I'm with you. It doesn't necessarily have to be a center.
Harm, great stuff as always. Always a pleasure to chat. Thanks for doing this. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, guys.
That is Harmon Dial from The Athletic joining us here on Sportsnet 650, calling in on the Power West, or the hotline powered by Power West Industries. Quick, before we wrap up here, Drancer, game two, Stars, Oilers tonight. What are you expecting to see tonight and for the rest of this series?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the Panthers that we've seen is when they turn up and hit that top gear, they can just bury you. And I think that's kind of what we're witnessing the Stars tap into.
Ooh.
With Rantanen and company,
mm-hmm.
right? Because we how many times have we seen it now?
Yeah.
Where they go into the third period looking like they're in dire straits.
My only hesitation is that it was the three power play goals in game one.
Well, and it was, but the power play is part of it. And we actually saw that in the game that they choked away against Vancouver, where they just demolished. Remember how
That's
hot
true.
The Canucks PK was going into that
yep.
game? They just so it's different. But it's
harder to rely on.
It's
right?
harder to
gotta
rely on.
Because you've got to get the opportunities.
Especially as you get later in a series. That was
yep.
very much a game one comeback.
Yeah.
Right? But the point being is that I do think with Rantanen and company, there is a offensive ceiling that the Stars can kind of tap into. And it's distinct, but it's similar in that it's like, what do we do well? What do you do well? Right? And the Stars in sort of a... More prone to getting outshot, but also hyper efficient and skilled in terms of what they're able to finish and convert on. Like Pete DeBoer, now that he has the horses, playing sort of absorb skill hockey against this Panthers team, honestly, sounds like a really fun finals to me. Even if I'd prefer to see McDavid, Panthers, part two. More
also, like, just think of the ratings in Helsinki if it's Florida, Dallas.
Yeah, it'd be a big win for Suomi.
For Finland, man.
No
that would be
doubt.
Absolutely incredible for the country, the proud country of Finland, to get to see that one. Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. Drance, great to have you back in studio on the show. Thank you for listening, everyone. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the weather. We're back on Monday for more Canucks talk here on Sportsnet 650.